From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Racial disparities in COVID-19 infections and deaths are stark, especially with Black and Brown communities. Now, even as the Republican Party seeks to downplay the pandemic or act as though it's in the past, disturbing statistics show that it continues to ravage communities of color. Today, we'll focus on Latinos in the U.S., who, like Black Americans, are disproportionately impacted. In the state of California, which has the largest Latino population in the nation, this demographic is particularly hard hit. A new UCLA study found that virus-related deaths among working-age Latino adults in California has multiplied disturbingly. Key to this grim conclusion is that Latinos are disproportionately represented in essential workforces and so face higher rates of exposure. My guest is Manuel Pastor, director of USC's Equity Research Institute. He's also a member of Governor Gavin Newsom's Task Force on Business and Jobs Recovery, tasked with ensuring statewide COVID recovery plans prioritize economic and racial equity. Welcome to the program, Manuel.
Glad to be with you again, Sonali.
So first, how seriously are Latinos impacted both nationwide, but even specifically in California, where we have the largest Latino population? This is a demographic that is unfortunately left out of the national discourse on these issues usually.
Well, it's actually a pretty dramatic, disproportionate impact. So Latinos, who are far less than a majority of the California population, are 60% of the cases. And what's remarkable about that is it's a younger population as well. So originally there were a lot of concerns about the way in which COVID was sort of ripping its way through older populations in nursing homes. But at the beginning of the pandemic in California, about 30% of the cases were Latino. Now about 60% of the cases are Latino. And the age-adjusted mortality rates, that is, trying to take account the age structure of the white population, the Black population, the Latino population, and other ethnic populations. The Black mortality rate, age-adjusted, is about twice that of the white population, and the Latino population is actually even higher than that. Interestingly, the population that's the most significantly disparate in terms of the age-adjusted mortality is the Pacific Islander population. And there's a couple of different factors which are driving this, both particularly for the Latinos and the Pacific Islanders. Latinos tend to be over-indexed in what's called essential work, that is, agricultural work, logistics, grocery store clerks, the kind of work that requires people to be there right now and actually be overexposed and proximate to a lot of people at work. Second big factor is that Latinos tend to be in overcrowded households. That is, multi-generational people sharing households, overcrowded conditions, which if one person gets sick from them going to work, it winds up ripping its way through an entire family. And third, Latinos tend to be well overrepresented in the undocumented population. And the reason why that's important is because the undocumented population is winding up going to work because they cannot access unemployment insurance or the federal relief checks. And they tend to, when they go back to their households that are overcrowded, send that going through the household and tend to be very fearful of interacting with community testing programs and public health departments because of the worries about being basically called out for being undocumented and running the risk of deportation. So 3 months ago, literally at the end of March, I was predicting that this was going to shift its way from whiter and wealthier communities that tended to have more contact with international travelers and international travel themselves. It would begin to rip its way through this community that was highly vulnerable because of its over-indexing, meaning over-concentration in essential work, because of the nature of its living conditions, tending to be in overcrowded households, and because of the fact that it was much more likely to be undocumented and therefore vulnerable. This is one of those sad predictions where I wish I hadn't been right, but it's what has taken place in the state of California.
What about farm workers, particularly in the Central Valley area of California? This is a, you know, community that is undocumented, low income, vulnerable, and yeah, you know, when you talk about essential, is literally ensuring that Americans are fed.
Yes, and I think that originally one of the things that was paid attention to, again, you need to think about essential risk that's also in close proximity to other people, so you could wind up having lots of infections. That was certainly the case with meatpacking plants, and we saw big outbreaks in California and also in the Midwest amongst Latino immigrant workers in meatpacking plants, essential work, also in close proximity. One of the thoughts about agricultural work was that people might be physically separated enough so that outbreaks wouldn't occur. But you need to understand that the workers who are in agriculture, they're often car sharing on their way to do work, even if they're physically separated when they're doing the picking, or they're being brought to work in transit like buses, which brings them into close proximity, and they tend to live in farm labor situations where there's a lot of people living in close proximity. So if one person gets it, even if they're not catching it through picking strawberries, they're going to catch it by the way they're getting to the strawberry field and to the way that they're living together. And those parts of their living experience were not fully taken into account. I think it's really been a situation where, the state in some ways has tried, but it has not fully taken into account the real lived experience of agricultural workers, grocery store workers, logistic workers, and others.
Right. I mean, when the issue of essential workers is so important to this conversation in the service industry, in farm work, in, you know, the landscape industry, the construction industry, you name, you know, the grocery and retail industries, Latinos are, and low income Latinos, those poorly paid jobs are largely filled in, you know, disproportionate amounts to their population by Latinos. So the exposure is higher.
Yeah, very much so. And let me make one other point, which I think is really, really critical, which is that Latinos and African-Americans are both over-indexed, meaning over-concentrated in essential high-risk jobs, meaning the jobs where the kind of contact and transmission you're talking about occurs. They were also both highly indexed in high-contact, non-essential occupations or industries like hospitality and restaurants. So they've simultaneously been hard hit by COVID at work and by being unemployed as a result of being in those industries that got shut down early, in which there's been a stop and start pattern to bringing people back. So it's been both ends of the economic and health scissors. That is, being exposed at work because you're in essential work and being finding yourself more likely to be laid off as a result of being in these industries like restaurant and hospitality. In fact, for example, Black workers, 50% of the Black workforce that was working as of February 2020 in California has since February 2020 filed for unemployment insurance claims. Wow. That's a result of people who were in those kind of jobs I'm talking about, but also who tended to be in gig employment. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has happened as a result of the federal relief package is that in addition to people who could file for regular unemployment, people were receiving W-2s because they had sort of regular jobs. People who are also in gig employment became eligible for what's called pandemic unemployment assistance. And so Black workers really were over-indexed in both the restaurant and hospitality, but also in the gig and precarious unemployment. Latino workers, not so much in terms of their unemployment claims, because so many people were undocumented and therefore not eligible to apply for either UI regular unemployment insurance claims, the pandemic unemployment insurance, and they were frozen out of the federal relief checks. Because if you were in a family, if you yourself are undocumented, even if you were filing and paying taxes through filing with what's called an individual taxpayer identification number, the Federal CARES Act said that anybody filing through that, they were ineligible. And if they were part of a family where the two the folks filing jointly, one had a social security number, meaning they were documented or U.S. citizen, and they filed, but they were filing jointly with somebody who had an ITIN, individual taxpayer identification number, signaling they were undocumented, that entire family unit and their children were rendered ineligible for the CARES Act. So they were really left stranded. You know, in many ways, to kind of step back from the details we've been going through, COVID is the disease that revealed our illness of precarious employment, our illness of structural racism in terms of who was over-indexed and what kinds of work, and our illness in terms of not having dealt with giving all immigrants the fundamental rights they deserve for working and contributing to this country. So really, it's just kind of lifted the veil on the kinds of patterns of inequality that we had before. And that lifting of the veil has been driven home by the moment of racial reckoning that we've had about understanding the police violence that's been unleashed against a Jacob Blake most recently, but a George Floyd a little bit further toward the beginning of the pandemic.
I want to ask you about the pre-existing health conditions impacting Latinos that might also, on top of everything we've been saying, make them vulnerable. You know, there's the infection rates, then there's the death rates, you know, the being able to survive the disease versus not being able to survive the disease, systemic racism, poor access to fresh, healthy food, poor access to proper health care can all leave individuals vulnerable to a disease like COVID-19. Is that also a factor when it comes to Latino populations?
It is definitely a factor with looking at the death rates, particularly the age-adjusted death rates. It's a more profound factor in the Black community,
right,
where the kind of combination of hypertension, which actually is just a feature of being Black in America, as the last couple of months have been showing us, obesity, diabetes, and all of those are actually things that come from structural factors like food deserts, lack of park space, and again, the stress of being Black in America. But those also operate in the Latino community. I mean, the stress of worrying about whether or not when you come home, your mother or father are going to have been deported by an ICE immigration enforcement, immigration and customs enforcement regime gone crazy, particularly under President Trump. There's also all of those issues of food deserts and not having access to park space also affect the Latino community. One other very special factor that affects the Latino community is the access, lack of access to health insurance and health care. A lot of that has to do with the ways in which racism for U.S.-born folks has played out in the United States, but also with immigrants who themselves might be undocumented and therefore worried about accessing what health insurance that might even be available in terms of emergency health insurance. But also we know that there's lots of families where they're mixed status families, and they're very concerned that if they exercise their right to be able to get Medi-Cal, which is the California version of Medicaid, for a family member who might be a legal immigrant, they're worried that that's going to expose their family member who is undocumented or count against them later on when they're moving to the issues of naturalization. So these are real issues that lead Latino immigrants to be reluctant to tap into resources that might actually be available for them.
So speaking of health insurance, I'd love to get into a little bit of a political discussion, if you don't mind. On August 21st, Cristina Jimenez Moreta, an immigrant justice activist, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about the Democratic National Convention called The Voices Missing from the Convention. And she was pointing out that, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just got a little over a minute to speak. Julian Castro was not even invited. And she pointed out that there was an enthusiasm gap for Joe Biden, even compared to Hillary Clinton from 4 years ago. And one reason, according to this writer, was that you have a Latino community that is struggling with issues of healthcare, struggling with COVID-19, lack of access to insurance, and you have a presidential candidate that's being offered to them who refuses to back Medicare for All. There was a very enthusiastic response to the Bernie Sanders campaign from the Latino community, primarily around those sorts of old government plans like Medicare for All that Sanders backed. And I'm wondering if you think that these are the kinds of political questions we need to be, you know, asking presidential candidates. How are you going to be off, you know, ensuring that everybody has health care, not just access or opportunity, but health care?
I think it's a very critical set of issues to ask the presidential candidates. And one of the things I think that the COVID crisis has revealed is the basic public health principle that to protect ourselves, we have to protect everyone. So one of the reasons why many of us are wearing a mask, even if we feel we might be healthy and not symptomatic, is that we're trying to protect others from what we might impart and asking them to do the same. And that is very much the case with health insurance. You know, the epidemic that's ravaging its way, particularly through immigrant Latino communities in California, is creating risks for everyone. And the way to have stopped that would have been to really make sure that everybody had access to healthcare, as you're mentioning, through something like Medicare for All, to make sure that we were forward positioning resources into those communities so that people would have more than adequate access to testing, and by community-based health promoters, promotoras, that would be people that people could trust, that they would have access to contact tracing, again, by local community people. So it's people you trust and you don't think that you're handing names over to someone who's going to deport the person that you work with, but rather is going to help to track the course of the disease. And what we need to do is not testing parity, but testing equity. Equity means making sure you get resources to people who actually desperately need them. At the more political level, I do think that Biden is going to need to do much more with the Latino community. And it's a lot more than developing ads in Spanish. This is also a younger community, which is much more intersectional and very much cares about issues like Black Lives Matter, that's being raised by Black Lives Matter around policing. But it also cares around education. It also cares around college student debt, which is incredibly important to younger Latinos, and it very much cares about full and comprehensive immigration reform and Medicare for All. I think the biggest mistake that the Biden campaign could make, particularly if they win, is the mistake that Obama made after he won, which is to postpone comprehensive immigration reform and making sure that all immigrants wind up having a place in America. It's a risk they're running. They assume that they have this vote because this vote is not going to vote, perhaps be enthusiastic, certainly, about voting for Donald Trump. But the margin of enthusiasm among Latino voters is going to be decisive in Arizona, and it may actually also be decisive in Texas, not so much in whether or not Biden wins in that state, but whether or not it's a competitive race that forces the Republicans to sink resources in that state to protect it. And it's going to be very decisive in unexpected places where, you know, there are Latinos in Wisconsin, there are Latinos in Michigan, there are Latinos in Iowa, and there's a significant Latino presence in Colorado. And engaging that part of the electorate will be very crucial to what happens in November 2020.
Right. A recent PBS NPR poll found that only 59% of Latinos said they would back Biden, compared to 66% who said they would back Hillary Clinton in 2016. I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier about access to testing and contact tracing. You know, we hear from the White House how carefully President Trump is being protected, with everybody being tested, contact traced, and in fact, several people have been, you know, found to be asymptomatically infected by the disease right before they met Trump because they're doing such rigorous testing. Those sorts of approaches are apparently not good enough for the rest of the country. Particularly in California, though, what is the access to testing, to free testing, to safe testing, and also contact tracing that the Latino community has? You know, the CDC just changed its guidelines saying people who might be exposed but asymptomatic shouldn't bother getting tested, which is pretty disturbing. But here, because Latinos are so disproportionately represented in essential work, not only are they more exposed, but then if they're exposed, they're going to be infecting others. There should be very systematic testing and contact tracing, right?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Just to loop back to the politics for a moment and then answer that question, I think one thing that's a big difference between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden is Clinton put in the work with the Latino community before. Whether or not, neither of those two have politics that are my politics, but I would acknowledge that Clinton put in the work building relationships and ties, particularly to traditional Latino leaders, and therefore might generate some enthusiasm. Biden does not have that history, and he's got a very short runway to be able to improve on that. On the question of testing, I think that the state of California is finally getting it. This week, the state of California is signing its own agreement with a testing company in Massachusetts. They're also trying to accelerate the quick turnaround kind of testing. And most fundamentally, there's been a realization that what you need to do is to get ahead of the problem. You know, there's one thing to take a look at where the disease has been and say, oh gosh, we've got to go to nursing homes. It's another to take a look at where the disease is heading. And it was entirely predictable that, and I say this partly because I was the one who was predicting that,
right,
that a community that was over-indexed in essential work, over-indexed in living in overcrowded housing, and over-indexed in being undocumented, which means that you're going to take the kind of risk that you need to do to feed your family because you're not getting any assistance from the government to make sure that you stay home. It was entirely predictable that this is where the disease would go, and this is where the disease has gone. And I feel like that message has finally gotten to Newsom administration, and that they are planning on getting much more aggressive about, and this has happened in LA County, where the message has finally gotten through to the County Department of Public Health, that what we need to do is to make sure that we've got the testing, contact tracing, and education in these communities, and also the space for people to quarantine so that if they get sick, they do not wind up staying in an overcrowded household, infecting other family members or household members. And that's going to require a very different kind of regime. You cannot have public health officials walk into a community. Our experience, for example, in Los Angeles is that those health clinics that have been there for a long time and built up public trust, they have an excess demand for the tests that are there. Those ones that have popped up recently and are run just by the Department of Health, they don't have that kind of demand. And in fact, they wind up people not trusting them, people not going there. So you really need to put resources into, I mean, I think you know this, Sally, what they're called, promotora campaigns, local community health promoters who have long-term relationships with the communities. And they're the ones that have to convince people that they need to be tested. They're the ones that have to steer people to the available testing. They're the ones who have to do the debriefing about where contact tracing, and they're the ones who have to help people when they get sick, say, I know it's hard, but you're going to need to separate from your family for 10 days while you wind up getting quarantined. Because family means a lot to these communities, to our communities. Right. And separating in order to protect your family is a message that needs to be there. I have a feeling that the state of California is finally getting this, and I hope that we communicate this to the rest of the United States as well.
Well, Manuel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time and insight.
Thank you for bringing this very important message out so that everyone understands that we need to do this and that it's not a question of blaming the victim. This high level of case rate and high level of death rate is not a function of Latinos somehow engaging in riskier behavior.
Which is what it's conservatives have said to explain it.
Well, and that might be the case folks who are rushing to bars, but that's not what's going on with Latinos. It's the essential work, the overcrowded conditions, the lack of support that have really made the difference. And if we, and it's also the structural racism that makes sure that if you've got a case, you're separated from healthcare. You're more likely to have underlying conditions, which is also affecting the African American community. So we need to own up to the fact that this is a structural problem in terms of where people are located in employment, housing, and support, and that it's a function of the structural racism that we've allowed and the lack of access to all the resources that people with full legal status have that we have allowed to go on too long. It's on us to change this and to make sure that we bring testing and health equity to this problem.
Thank you so much, Manuel, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Manuel Pastor, director of the University of Southern California's Equity Research Institute. He's also a member of California Governor Gavin Newsom's Task Force on Business and Jobs Recovery, tasked with ensuring statewide COVID recovery plans prioritize economic and racial equity. We've been discussing the impact of the coronavirus on Latinos in California and the United States at large. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.